From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump and Joe Biden are putting miles on the odometer in the Midwest today as the 2020 campaign races toward the finish line. Both will hold events in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Trump will go on to Michigan, Biden to Iowa. And while the upper Midwest may hold the key to the White House, the race also depends on working class voters in Pennsylvania. President Trump seems to know that. He has five rallies scheduled in that state before Election Day. Robert Costa is national political reporter at the Washington Post. And Robert, here we are heading into the final weekend of the 2020 campaign. What's the state of the race?
It all comes down to Pennsylvania, based on my reporting, my conversations with voters, but also with strategists in both parties, because this is the key battleground in the industrial Midwest, also partly in the Mid-Atlantic. And this is the kind of place Vice President Biden needs to do well in, and he's paying a lot of attention to it. This is a narrow race in some of these key states, even though Vice President Biden is leading nationally pretty easily.
Well, do you see President Trump showing any signs of turning it around in the final days as he did in 2016?
There's a lot of enthusiasm on the Trump side. The question is, does that enthusiasm counter the erosion Trump's facing in the suburbs and in the cities? Democrats are not going to be caught flat-footed like they were in 2016 in places like Philadelphia or Milwaukee. And you see suburban women, based on my reporting in the polls, turning away from the president because of the pandemic. The pandemic remains the burden on the president's shoulders politically, even though he has a lot of energy on his side.
Well, 4 years ago, you took a road trip across your home state of Pennsylvania. That was in the final week of the campaign as well. And you ended up writing a front page story in the Washington Post, which essentially foreshadowed the Trump victory to come in the state that year. And I know this year you checked back in with some of those people. Here's some tape from Elizabeth Parker, who didn't vote in 2016 because she thought Clinton was a shoo-in.
I'm a hospice nurse, and I think the saddest part of this pandemic is that it hasn't been controlled and it's been let loose.
Do you blame President Trump?
I blame the rhetoric that is used right now. It's almost cult-like, the way his supporters are acting.
So there you go. Just as you said, people thinking a lot about the pandemic in this election. How would you compare what you heard this year to 2016?
When I went across in 2016, took a 350-mile road trip, it was evident that there was an appetite for what I called radical change, for someone to really shake up the system. Even if they didn't like President Trump's character in Western and Central Pennsylvania, there was an eagerness for change. 4 years later, many of those voters in Western and Central Pennsylvania still like President Trump. And in Northeastern Pennsylvania, they like him on trade. But you're seeing suburban voters, mostly white liberal suburban voters, moderate Republicans, say they've had enough, whether it's the president's character, his handling of the pandemic. And you also see black voters, as a racial reckoning happens in this country, focused on reprimanding President Trump politically. They see him as someone who stokes the fires on race, and they would like to see him gone.
So what does Pennsylvania come down to this year? I mean, which of these candidates is making a better pitch to the voters of Pennsylvania?
It comes down to the protectionist Union Democrat in Pennsylvania, who lives maybe in Aliquippa, where I start my journey on tonight's special, or in Scranton, Pennsylvania, home to anti-abortion Democrats like the late Bob Casey Sr., the governor, and Bob Casey Jr., the current senator. They may have drifted, been tempted by the siren song of protectionism and nationalism and populism by President Trump in 2016. 4 years later, they may still agree with President Trump on trade, but is the avalanche of other issues and controversies enough to sweep them toward Biden? And that's the voter I'm watching. That's the voter who seemed most undecided at this 11th hour.
Can you tell if any of them are coming back to the Democrats?
I think the Democrats' whole gamble going back to earlier this year with Biden was that he could win that kind of voter over. Middle class Joe, that was his reputation in Delaware. He's always touted his roots in Northeastern Pennsylvania. And that is the whole election. It comes down to those voters. The suburban voters are going to give Biden a boost. Black voters, white liberals in the cities are going to give Biden a boost. But can he actually swing the Union Democrat back?
What's the likelihood that we see a legal battle over ballot counting or some other issue in Pennsylvania in the days after the election?
Undoubtedly, it's going to happen. The Supreme Court recently ruled that a Pennsylvania state Supreme Court ruling can stand. In short, it's going to allow ballots to be counted up to 3 days after the election. And that is to improve access to the ballot amid a pandemic. Democrats feel good about that. But the challenge for Democrats is the vote day count, election day count, may be better for President Trump. So they're going to preach patience, and they have the courts on their side, but it'll be a battle royale, no doubt about it. And you could see issues rise up about voter suppression or voting rights. Who knows how this plays out, but it's already being fought in the courts. That means to me as a reporter, it's almost certainly going to be fought next week and beyond.
Yeah, we'll see. And you'll be there to watch it. Robert Costa, national political reporter at the Washington Post, moderator and managing editor of Washington Week. His special report, Revisiting the Pennsylvania Voters He Spoke With Back in 2016, airs tonight on PBS. Robert, enjoy the home stretch. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And as the candidates are making their final arguments ahead of next Tuesday, the internet is continuing to pump out the memes with some spoofs so believable even documentary filmmaker Michael Moore got fooled into thinking one comedian's satire was actually reality. And for more on how the presidential race is on social media and what's trending, let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us now via Skype. Femi, happy Friday.
Thank you. At last, finally.
At last. So, Femi, one of the Trump strategies is to woo voters with endorsements from celebrities. And just this week, we heard about an endorsement from rapper Lil Wayne and 50 Cent, who 50 Cent specifically a few days later recanted his initial support. What does the internet have to say about Wayne's endorsement?
Lil Wayne trended on Thursday. He tweeted a picture with himself and President Trump smiling broadly in front of three US flags. The president retweeted the picture and the tweet. This is what Lil Wayne says. He says, just had a great meeting with our real Donald Trump. Besides what he's done so far with criminal reform, the Platinum Plan is going to give the community real ownership. He listens to what we had to say and he assured he will and can get it done. Mm. This sparked a huge conversation online about Black conservatives and rappers. BH posts, rappers are not leaders of Black people. Twitter ignores her. Brady Pappy says, so you just ignore those racial slurs at Trump rallies? Question mark, question mark, question mark. Tiger Uppercut WDE posts this. The party of tolerance melting down because Lil Wayne has a mind of his own. And I'm going to give Matt Serpley the last line here. If Lil Wayne influences who you vote for, then you need to reevaluate your life choices.
I was afraid to click on them, Femi, so I've seen the pictures, but thank you for explaining.
There's a lot in there.
Yeah. Also, this week, we learned the identity of Anonymous, the author of the 2018 op-ed they called the president petty and ineffective. Now we know that Anonymous is, in fact, Miles Taylor, a former Homeland Security official. And here he is on CNN with Chris Cuomo earlier this week.
I owe Anderson Cooper a beer. I owe him a mea culpa. And the same thing for other reporters who at that time period asked me, are you Anonymous? And I said no.
Oh, so interesting. Do you think Anderson Cooper is actually going to take Miles Taylor up on that beer? And how are people really reacting to this news?
I think Anderson Cooper might do one of his legendary eye rolls at that idea.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, let's see about some praise for Miles Taylor. Not that much. Caitlin puts it this way. Okay, I'm seeing many tweets that are angry at Miles Taylor, but could you try to see it from two perspectives? Yes, it's frustrating when it is denounced as not credible, but he was doing his best to reassure Americans about Trump in 2018 while working in that position. Donald Trump Jr. just laughs. Emojis, that crying laughing emoji. He says the supposed high-level administration official was a DHS staffer. No one I know has even heard of him. Crying laughing emoji.
You know, one last thing that I've been thinking about, Femi, is how this year, of course, feels so absurd in so many ways. We kind of have to constantly check whether we're reading The Onion, you know? And sometimes we get fooled, which is exactly what happened this week when comedian Blair Erskine posted a video parroting a Trump voter at his recent Omaha rally, where a number of supporters were actually stranded waiting for buses to pick them up. And some were even hospitalized for hypothermia. Let's listen.
I'm having a great time. I can't feel my body, but I don't really need my body. This is about Trump's body. Yes, I've seen some elderly people passed out and unresponsive. But to be honest, the only reason there's so many of those people is because the media keeps counting them.
I mean, Femi, it is obvious that she's joking, but then it's not, because a lot of people got tricked by this.
A lot of people were really upset with her. The MC Hammer says it's even worse than we thought. The light is on, but nobody's at home. And then people on Blair's Instagram account said, should you tell him or should we? A lot of people were fooled. Blair was really, really good at playing a Trump supporter. And also, I think it speaks to what you said, Tonya, is that sometimes we can't tell the ridiculous from the actual truth. This is where we are right now.
Yeah, it's why we always have to check before we reshare, for sure.
That's always.
Femi, always. That's Femi Oge, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, as always. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Before COVID-19, Chinatowns were thriving places where so many of us gathered with friends to get our favorite dumplings or to celebrate Lunar New Year. And these days, it's also where photographer Andrea Low and writer Valerie Liu are getting life lessons and fashion tips from Chinatown's senior citizens. They're the brains behind the blog and new book, Chinatown Pretty: Fashion and Advice from Chinatown's Most Stylish Seniors. And they join us now. Welcome.
Tonya, thanks so much
for having us.
Chinatown Pretty, what a name. Tell me how you all started this process of documenting the Chinatown seniors.
Yeah, Andrea and I started just by going out on dim sum dates in San Francisco Chinatown. And we both were just responding to the style that we saw. There was a lot of colors, textures, and it was so surprising and so joyful that we wanted to know, how did these seniors put their outfits together? And where did they get those shoes? So it was born out of curiosity of kind of the clothes. And as we got to meet more seniors, the clothes became a gateway to learn more about their immigration stories, the independent lives they live in this urban area, and also the wisdoms they have for, everybody.
Yes, this is really about placing value on our elders, seeing them as full people, really. And really, as you write, it's about connecting with your own sense of self. Were people receptive to being interviewed, and did they understand this project? Andrea?
We really had to let them know, you look beautiful, because they didn't quite understand why we were interested in them. They would often be like, oh, this jacket, this old thing. But I think by the end of the conversation, they would start to understand why we thought they were so beautiful and why we were inspired by them. And also through the project, speaking to people maybe my parents' age, not quite senior citizens yet, but the children of the people that we would stop and talk to, we found that they would also start to understand, oh, I never really thought that my grandma or my mom or my dad looked so beautiful, but they would start to understand and to notice as well.
The book and the photographs in it are just beautiful. They're just absolutely beautiful and also really joyful. Did any of the people you spoke with make a lasting impact on you?
I think that's one of the most beautiful parts of this project, is not only seeing these joyful outfits, but just connecting with seniors, despite language and cultural barriers. Today, I was just looking at a picture of Hoi Tang Dang, who we met in San Francisco Chinatown. He had on two hats, a beanie and an ivy cap, cocked to one side. And I've never seen that before. And, we learned more about his story. And at the end, he was like, do you want my hat? So there were just so many cute, touching, beautiful encounters with people in the book.
You all also had a chance to connect with someone named Dorothy, or as you all call her, Polka Dot. And I can imagine that this quarantine for all of the seniors has been really hard on all of them. But I'm thinking about Polka Dot. How is she doing?
She lives a really active life. She wakes up at 6 a.m. every day, listens to Democracy Now!, and exercises in bed for that hour. So she does all her workout before she even gets out of bed.
Oh my God.
But she's making the most out of quarantine, and her spirits have been pretty high. But when I saw her the other night, we ended up going out to dinner, and she said, my spirits didn't need to be lifted, but they were. But overall, she's been making good use of the time.
Making good use of the time, indeed. And she's also really been thinking about the election We have some sound from her. Let's listen.
This election has helped me to be more positive in the sense of I can do something in terms of my not only my vote, but also to be more activated. So I've been, one of them was to embroider 2 T-shirts that when I go out, I wear. The most recent one is accountability. But at the same time, when I do feel discouraged, I think that, well, it's up to my grandson's age, who just turned 18. So that's the one encouragement I have for the younger generation. Do something.
Andrea, what did you learn about yourself in this process and having these types of conversations with seniors like Dorothy?
Yeah, I learned that everyone, of course, had very unique stories, but I was also able to somehow fit my own personal background and come to understand it better, my family's background and their immigration story in sort of the broader history of immigration patterns. And speaking with these people, you know, those patterns started to merge of like, these are the jobs, like seamstresses. That was like one of the only jobs that Chinese immigrants could take upon immigrating because you didn't need to know English. And just understanding that and my own family's overlap has been really great.
What about you, Valerie?
I think what's beautiful about the people we meet in Chinatown is just the resilience. A lot of people immigrated over here, had to start over, and that's part of our dedication in the book is to anyone that's had to start over. And my family, you know, they immigrated from Vietnam after the war, and just how people are able to carry on, live independent lives, and dress joyfully despite everything they've been through.
Hmm. Are those the messages you want folks to take away from China Pretty, especially now in this current moment?
Yeah, it's, you know, what we always tell people, or the seniors we meet, is Po Po Ho Ling, which means, Grandma, you look good. And so one of our takeaways and what we want to share is like, just tell elders they look fantastic. It's a simple way to engage, which is more important now more than ever.
And if I can add to that, Chinatown's still there. You don't have to miss it. It's open and it's waiting for you. So just go check it out. Go eat dinner. Take a stroll around. It's still thriving and it's still there for you.
That's Andrea Lowe and Valerie Liu, the creators of Chinatown Pretty. Thank you so much for your work and sharing this with us.
Thank you for having us.
Tomorrow night's sky will feature what's called a blue moon. That's when we get 2 full moons in a single calendar month. It's a rare occurrence and the source of the saying, once in a blue moon. Could the classic pop song that shares its name give us hope during another rare occurrence? Judith Kogan has the story.
That's the doo-wop group The Marcells with their 1961 version of Blue Moon. Composer Richard Rodgers and lyricist Lawrence Hart wrote the song back in 1934. It wasn't a nod to the astronomic calendar, but a response to a challenge by MGM's music publisher Jack Robbins. The duo had originally written the song with some pretty dark lyrics for the 1933 film Hollywood Party. The song was never recorded, but it was registered with the Copyright Office as an unpublished work. Hart wrote new lyrics for the tune to create a title song for the 1934 film Manhattan Melodrama. But that song was cut from the film before release. Then the studio asked Rodgers and Hart for a nightclub number for the film. Rodgers still liked the melody, so Hart wrote a third set of lyrics, still pretty dark, and called it The Bad in Every Man. Here's singer Shirley Ross.
Oh, Lord, what is the matter with me? I'm just permitted to see the bad in every man.
Evans thought the song had commercial potential, but that to sell, it needed more romantic lyrics and a catchier title. So he offered the songwriting team a deal. If Hart could turn the lyrics into one of those Tin Pan Alley love songs, Robbins promised to plug it from one end of the country to the other. Full of cynicism, Lawrence Hart rewrote the lyrics yet again. He didn't personally like what he came up with, but it became a big hit, a million seller in sheet music, and his most popular song. Why? As Billie Holiday reminds us, it plays on the answered prayer.
And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold.
A pandemic is even rarer than a blue moon, which occurs about once every 3 years. And unlike the problem of Blue Moon's love-starved singer, a cure for the coronavirus isn't going to suddenly appear. But as the song suggests, prayers sometimes do get answered. And that, along with progress on the vaccine front, gives us and the chairman of the board a bit of hope.
And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
For Here and Now, I'm Judith Kogan.
Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
If you want to buy a gun or ammunition at Walmart, you're going to need to make a special request. The retail giant has pulled the products from display in its stores, citing the recent unrest in some cities. Meanwhile, gun sales ahead of the election are soaring. Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. He's on a Skype line. Mike, welcome back. Good to speak with you.
Thanks. You too, Peter.
And Walmart has done this before, most recently after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, sparked protests and looting. Is Walmart afraid that people are going to come in and steal their guns?
Yeah, that's basically it, Peter. And maybe not just steal them, but then actually turn around and use them in the store, possibly. The statement from the company basically says that they're reacting to the civil unrest around the country and that this move is a precaution for the safety of their associates and customers. And I think the issue is that the looting we've seen this year has been scattered across the country. It hasn't really been isolated to certain cities or regions, and it's very hard to predict where it could erupt next. So from Walmart's perspective, I imagine it makes the most sense to them to just pull the guns and ammo from the shelves across the entire nation, Peter.
And just to be clear, Walmart is still selling guns. It's just that you have to go in and ask for them.
Right, right. This is just pulling them off the shelves on the sales floor. They are still available upon request.
All right. So what kind of line is Walmart walking here? Because on the one hand, they're taking these guns out of stores because they don't want people to come in, loot them, or use them inside the store. On the other hand, they stopped selling certain types of guns and ammo altogether after the shootings at their stores in El Paso, Texas, of course, in Mississippi. This is fraught political territory for a big company like Walmart, isn't it?
It sure is. You remember last year they were criticized pretty heavily by the NRA for the restrictions they announced last year, while at the same time they were criticized by high-profile politicians like Elizabeth Warren because they were still selling guns at all. So they've been trying to react and do what they think is reasonable and responsible in how they approach gun sales while not exactly exiting the business completely. But like you said, Peter, it's a very tough needle to thread politically.
Mm. And the truth is that gun sales are soaring in this country. Americans have bought a record 17 million guns this year, according to an analysis by The Guardian, which, you know what, Mike, is actually pretty common in an election year. What do you see?
It is. You know, I think what's different in this election year is that these sales have been driven by people really thinking they need a gun, that the state of the civil unrest, whether it be the defund the police movement, and just this nervousness about the economy and the pandemic seems to be what's driving the sales rather than the usual pre-election boost that is a result of people thinking that a Democratic Congress or president could curtail the amount of guns available. So this is really driven by people's fear and concerns, which is kind of alarming.
Yeah, and according to that analysis by The Guardian, Americans bought almost as many guns in 2016 leading up to the presidential election because they thought Hillary Clinton would pass policies that would take their guns away. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, thanks very much for joining us and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you, Peter.
It's the season for scary music, so let's spend a few minutes with a melody that has defined scary since the Middle Ages. It's the Dies Irae, that's Latin for Day of Wrath, and its power is in its first four notes. Dies Irae, Dies Irae, Soles Egum Infamina, Teste David Concibina. Well, joining us now is a man who calls himself the Dies Irae Guru, Berklee College of Music professor Alex Ludwig. For the past couple of years, he's been compiling examples of this music in popular film scores. He's up to three volumes now. Alex, welcome. It's a little early, but happy Halloween.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we can hear that eerie chanting there, but what is Dies Irae, the Day of Wrath? Where did it come from?
Yeah, so this piece of music is drawn from the Requiem Mass. So we're talking about music that's been around for 500, 600, 700 years. And it was always chanted during a funeral. So this piece of music is associated right from the start with the Last Judgment. And so the text is, in translation, is talking about fire and brimstone. And so we've got this sort of programmatic sense of darkness and dread coupled with this, the musical material itself.
And how did you get so interested in it that it became a part of your identity?
Well, I teach music history classes here at Berklee, and there is a piece of classical music called the Symphonie Fantastique that appears in a number of my classes. And it quotes this Dies Irae in it. And then I started noticing it in more and more film scores. I also teach a class on the history of film music. So this Dies Irae music started popping up in weird places, and it sort of piqued my interest.
Well, as luck would have it, we actually have that piece of music you're referring to. In 1830, the French composer Hector Berlioz used it in the last movement of Symphonie Fantastique. Here it is. That is some dark music. I mean, you can't hear that without, you know, picturing darkness and shrouds and clouds. In fact, it was used to convey a witch's Sabbath. Why was this piece of music significant in the early days of Dies Irae?
Yeah, so this movement in particular is really fascinating because the symphony as a whole, it tells a story. And it tells the story of an artist and his beloved. And by the time we get to the last movement, this movement that we just heard quoted, the Dream of a Witch's Sabbath, portraying a graveyard at midnight. And what Berlioz, the composer, is trying to portray here is skeletons dancing and witches swirling around a cauldron. And so we hear two things in that clip. We hear the Dies Irae, which is sort of the perfect sort of musical accompaniment, but we also heard the church bells tolling midnight. So Berlioz is using all the tools at his disposal to create the spooky atmosphere of a witch's Sabbath.
And what is it about that sound and the music that makes it scary?
first of all, these first four notes, and it's really these first four notes that kind of get excerpted out and have a second life of their own, and we can get to that. But those first four notes, they are very close together. The first two notes are half step apart, the closest interval we have in sort of Western art music. And when you play those in close succession, we feel that dissonance between the two, that half step. But when we look at those four notes as a whole, the first note to the last note outlines a minor third. And so we have this sense of minor music, and we associate that generally with sadness, with darkness, whereas major mode music tends to be brighter and cheerier. So the question is, and this is what sort of fascinates me about the Dies Irae, is this music has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. And are we associating those notes, the music itself, with sadness because the Dies Irae has been associated with this text? Or do we hear these notes as ominous in and of themselves? If we had just played those first four notes, would they be scary? Or is it because we've been thinking about this funeral mass for hundreds and hundreds of years that we connect the notes with this connotation?
Well, that's such an interesting question, because maybe also we have been trained without knowing it to experience that as scary music because it crops up in popular culture so much. So if we fast forward about 100 years from Berlioz to the score for the groundbreaking 1927 German silent film Metropolis, we get this. Well, there it is. So how did we make the jump to film with the Dies Irae?
Well, and that's what's really fascinating to me as a scholar, both of classical music, but also the history of film music, is that in the late 19th century, we see a lot of classical compositions sort of in the shadow of Berlioz. So a lot of compositions that deal with have death in the title. And then the first generation of silent films, capped off by Metropolis in 1927, once we start getting film music, those early composers were really trained in composers of the late 19th century. So it's very easy to guess that they brought that practice from the 19th century into the early 20th century. And suddenly we start to see this Dies Irae a few different times in the early world of talking pictures. And then really once we advance up to the 1970s, it really explodes into much more popular films and becomes much more widely heard.
And we've got some examples here right now of that, starting in 1977, when composer John Williams used it in Close Encounters. Again, in the original Star Wars movie. Here it is in Alien from 1979 at the end of the film with Sigourney Weaver.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.
And then in 1980, here it is in The Shining. So as a casual movie buff or watcher, I never would have made this connection, but clearly the film composers did. Why do you think it is so popular on screen?
Well, and this is where I really get to dig in a little bit, because the more I started to categorize these and list them, I realized that they were occurring in a couple of different variations. In The Shining, we heard the full statement, the full first phrase of the chant. Now, that's pretty unusual. We don't often hear the full statement. Usually what composers have done is focused on those first four notes, that sort of that opening stinger. And so that's where we hear it in Star Wars, especially that burning homestead cue when Luke discovers his aunt and uncle killed by the Empire. John Williams plays that same melody that we've heard again and again, and then he adds in this little tag at the end, those four notes stinger of the Dies Irae, sort of emphasizing the death of his aunt and uncle and the fact that he now has to go on this adventure.
And it was also found in Poltergeist in 1982 during that scene when the skeletons are bubbling up in the rainstorm from the bottom of a swimming pool. But what's the scariest example of a dies irae that you can think of?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, you were talking about Poltergeist before, and that's a great example. The Omen as well, at the very opening titles of The Omen, both scores by Jerry Goldsmith, who's on my list quite a bit.
All right, well, at your suggestion, we're going to go out listening to the score from The Omen. Alex Ludwig teaches at Berklee College of Music and is the self-described dies irae guru. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
For the last 7 months, U.S. and Canadian border crossings have been closed to most travelers, and people who work and live on either side are coping with the latest news that it will remain closed for at least one more month. Earlier this month, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he won't allow American visitors into Canada until the U.S. lowers its coronavirus numbers, which is looking unlikely anytime soon as cases surge across the country. Brian Higgins represents Western New York's border with Ontario and Congress, and he joins us now with more. He's a Democrat. Congressman, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Congressman Higgins, you've called on President Trump to allow exemptions to the cross-border travel ban. Have you received any response from the administration?
No, not yet. And this is a continuing problem with this administration. The border with the United States, Canada, closed on March 21st, and reviews it every, you know, month, and, you know, has said that unless and until the number of COVID-19 cases comes down in the United States, that border is going to remain closed. And I think it's the tale of two countries and their dealings with the coronavirus. The Canadian federal government response was early, strong, and unified. The United States federal government response was slow, sloppy, and chaotic. You know, the Canadian officials, I understand their position. My obligation, I have two obligations. One is to keep trying, but the other is to be honest with people. And unless and until our cases come down, that border between the United States and Canada is going to remain closed.
Well, let's talk about the impact. People living close to the U.S. border may have family or jobs on the other side. And the border has been closed to non-essential travel since, as you said, March. Give us a sense of the social and economic impact this border closure is having on your district.
Well, I'm a Buffalo guy, but, you know, I grew up in the Canadian shores of Lake Erie because that was the tradition in my city. You know, people rented cottages. Some people that, you know, had some wealth bought property. But that's what we did every summer. It's like, you know, that's where we vacationed. Buffalo is situated on the border with Ontario. Ontario is the most populated province of Canada, which includes Toronto. It's 14 million people, and the economy of Buffalo and Western New York, my community, is highly dependent on reliable, predictable, regular access to and from Southern Ontario and the province of Ontario. 40% of the customers at the Buffalo Niagara International Airport are from Ontario. Canadians spend $10 million a year for healthcare services in the Buffalo Niagara region. Sales tax revenues coming into the County of Erie, and on the weekends, 80% of those revenues are from the Canadian shopper. So the impact is profound.
Yeah. You know, I keep using the term essential travel, non-essential travel. Who and what is actually allowed to travel across the border now? And what kind of extra exemptions would you like to see?
Yeah, it would be freight movements, commercial trucks that are carrying product to and from Ontario to into Buffalo and Western New York. And the essential traveler is law enforcement, medical personnel. And what I was seeking to do is getting the category of essential traveler to be expanded to include people that own property over in Canada, people that have a business interest, and people that have relatives. But, you know, as frustrated as people are on the American side that the border is not open, they understand it because there's only one statistic that matters, and that is the number of COVID-19 cases you have per 100,000 population. And in New York State, including Buffalo, we have 7 times more cases than Ontario, and we have 10 times more deaths. So, you know, the Canadian federal officials and public health officials are right. Americans are not wanted in Canada. Americans are not welcomed in 27 European countries. It's a sad commentary on you know the federal government response to COVID-19.
Mm. Yeah, this latest extension is set to end November 21st, but it's the 7th time the non-essential travel ban has been extended. You're laying this out very clearly that we need to work harder to lower the case count, and that should be our number one priority. But how much longer are you telling your constituents in Western New York to prepare for these restrictions to remain?
It is frustrating for them, but I think, you know, again, they see the statistics every single day. And as our cases spike, there is just no likelihood that anything's going to change in the short term. As I said, I try. You know, I'm dealing with the United States ambassador to Canada, the Canadian ambassador to the United States, Canadian government officials, but it's very hard to make a compelling case when the facts are against you. And the disparity here between the number of COVID-19 cases in Ontario versus New York State and Buffalo and Western New York, the community that I represent, are very stark.
That's Representative Brian Higgins, Democrat of New York. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
The candidates make their final pitches before Tuesday's election with record early voting amid the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have the latest next time on Here and Now.